employed by the Arabs during one of the many occasions when we know they repaired Fortress Baalbek after it had been attacked and pounded by enemy catapults. Moreover, as though to underline the impermanence of every redeployable feature in the walls of Baalbek, even that bit of column drum, which can also be seen in a photograph taken before the First World War and reproduced in 1980 by Friedrich Ruget, was removed in more recent restorations, as Santhafaya's images from 2014 in the plate sections show. Indeed, the Arabs regularly and routinely cannibalized, reused, and repurposed Roman column drums and parts of column drums. Moreover, as we saw in Chapter 12, and as Michael Aloof, a man who knew the ruins intimately for more than 50 years, confirms, the foundations of Baalbek were repeatedly undermined during the numerous sieges that the sanctuary suffered while it served as a fortress. After the sieges, the foundations were naturally repaired, otherwise whole sections of wall would have collapsed, and it is my view that this, rather than original Roman construction, is the most plausible explanation for the column drum found in the foundations beneath the Trilithon. Why, after all, if the Romans made these foundations, as the orthodox theory requires us to accept, would they have suddenly used a column drum at this point, when they would surely have had plenty of regular blocks, specifically cut and dressed for the purpose, at their disposal? It simply doesn't make sense. But Arab masons repairing an undermined foundation would have used whatever lay at hand, and the centuries of warfare, earthquakes, and other disasters that Baalbek suffered meant that there were enormous quantities of broken columns lying around, as there still are to this day. There is also another possibility, which is that the Romans did in fact put the column drum into the wall, but again as a repair rather than as an act of original construction. If the megalithic wall was already very ancient when the Romans came on the scene, and if it was their intention to use it as a base for further construction, they would undoubtedly have surveyed the foundations and repaired any sectors that the years had not been kind to. I scrawl, "Find out more about that column drum," across a page of my notebook. The matter isn't closed yet, one way or the other, but the hypothesis that the Romans were not the original builders of the U-shaped megalithic wall, of which the Trilithon is an integral part, continues to look viable to me, and worthy of further investigation. It's time to see the Trilithon from the outside. I leave my welcome patch of shade, poke around a little longer on top of the giant blocks, and then retrace my steps eastwards through the Temple of Jupiter complex. Eventually, it's a long walk, I find my way back to the main entrance of the site, pass through the propylaea and down the main stairs, turn right and follow the path that runs parallel to the southern exterior wall of the fortress the Arabs made of this place. The Temple of Venus comes into view a few hundred meters southeast of the main ruins. It's beautiful, but irrelevant to my purposes, so I ignore it and press on towards the southwest, passing two more Arab towers built into the fortification walls and eventually coming to a gateway in the fence through which I can see the Trilithon in the distance. A guard is there. He makes a great show of keeping me out, but money changes hands, the gate is opened with a flourish, and I'm on my way through an orchard of shriveled trees to get a better look at the three largest blocks ever used in any construction anywhere in the world. The highest pinnacle of power and science. In the 19th century, David Urquhart, a learned Scotsman, travelled widely in Lebanon, eventually publishing his History and Diary in 1860. He never explained where he got the hint from, but it was his belief that Baalbek had played an important part in the secretive maritime empire of the Phoenicians, whose exploits started to be remarked upon by other cultures in the second millennium BC, and who were descended from the original Canaanite people of this region. Indeed, the Phoenicians usually referred to themselves as Canaanites. Renowned for their seafaring abilities, and especially for their uncanny, or perhaps one should say instead, precise and scientific navigational skills, they established ports all around the coasts of the Mediterranean as far afield as Tunisia, Morocco, Spain, Italy, Turkey, Cyprus, and Malta. Their heartland was in Lebanon, however, and their first city was Byblos, to the north of modern Beirut, with other important centers at Tyre and Sidon. There is much that is mysterious about the Phoenicians, and they have often been reproached by frustrated researchers for having been so persistently silent about themselves and for having left no written history of their own. Everything we know about them comes from the annals of other races, and they have only foreign advocates to plead their cause to posterity. One of those foreign advocates was the Greek scholar Philo, who lived in Byblos in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD. Hence he is known as Philo of Byblos. His Phoenician history purported to be a translation of a book written by one Sanchuniathon, a Phoenician sage who had supposedly lived more than 1,000 years earlier. Sanchuniathon's writings have not come down to us in any other source. Moreover, like the works of the Babylonian priest Berossos, whom the reader will recall from earlier chapters, Philo's own Phoenician history has also been lost. All that is left of it are fragments preserved as quotations and summaries by other authors, notably the 4th century church father Eusebius. In these fragments, we read of the exploits of a god, identified with the Greek deity Uranos, whose name means sky or heaven, and who invented betils by devising stones endowed with life. There are a couple of points of interest here. First of all, obviously, we are back in the realm of betils, those meteoritic stones fallen from heaven that are so often part of the debris stream of fragmenting comets, and that were treated as cult objects throughout the ancient Near East. If we look into the etymology of the word betil, we find that it means home of the god, and the home of Uranus is, of course, the sky, the right place for objects of meteoritic origin. Secondly, there is this curious reference to stones endowed with life, which significantly is given in some translations as stones that moved as having life. In this, I couldn't help but be reminded of traditions from ancient Egypt that spoke of huge stones being effortlessly moved around by magicians using words of power. For example, there is an account, preserved on British Museum Papyrus number 604, of the deeds of the magician Horus the Nubian, who made a vault of stone 200 cubits long and 50 cubits wide rise above the head of Pharaoh and his nobles. When Pharaoh looked up at the sky, he opened his mouth in a great cry, together with the people who were in the court. Since 200 cubits by 50 cubits equates to approximately 100 meters by 25 meters, 328 feet by 82 feet, it is obvious that any magician who could raise such a massive block would have no difficulty raising the megaliths of the Trilithon, which are less than a quarter of that size. At any rate, this thought of the magicians of the gods brings us back by a circuitous route to David Urquhart, who tells us in his history and diary what it was that led him to Baalbek in the mid-19th century. "I was drawn thither by the Betilia, the Betils, that mystery of the ancient writers, which I believe to have been magnets used in the Phoenician vessels engaged in distant traffic, and which on return of their fleets were conveyed in religious procession to the temple at Baalbek, to remain there until the fleets were again sent forth." Unfortunately, Urquhart found no hints of the lost technology, the magical magnetic stones he was looking for in Baalbek. "Where is the temple that held the Betilia?" he asked. "It has disappeared." He deduced that it must have stood upon the platform and was probably pulled down to make way for the Roman temples. He therefore contented himself with an inquiry into the mysteries of the Trilithon and of an even larger cutstone block that his local informants showed him lying abandoned in the quarry half a mile to the south of the ruins. "These ruins," he noted, "when you imagine them without the later temples now stuck on the top, were nothing but a quadrangular enclosure." One can conceive the hewing out of enormous blocks for the statue of a king, the ornament of a palace, or the pomp of a temple, but here there is no such object, There is no conceivable object by which such an effort can be explained. This was one of a series of questions to which Urquhart could propose no answers of his own. First, why build with such huge blocks? Beside which, Stonehenge is a nursery toy. Second, why build here, since Baalbek was not a great capital or a great port, but stood far inland? Third, why was the work suddenly stopped, as evidenced by the block in the quarry and by the unfinished state of the U-shaped wall in which the trilithon is set? And fourth, why was Baalbek unique? This structure is alone, Urquhart noted. There is nothing upon earth in the remotest degree resembling it. That night, Urquhart dined with the emir of Baalbek and asked him whom the huge U-shaped enclosure had been built by. The emir replied in rather matter-of-fact tones that there had been three phases of construction. The megalithic work had been done at the command of two different rulers in the primeval period before the flood. And then came the deluge. After that, it was repaired by Solomon. When he was on his way back to Beirut, Urquhart reflected on what the emir had told him, concluding that it touched on a fundamental truth, and that the stones of Baalbek had to be considered as some of those sturdy fellows who the deluge could not sweep away. More than that, it seemed to him that before the deluge, the whole course of human society had been run. The builders of Baalbek must have been a people who had attained to the highest pinnacle of power and science, and this region must have been at the center of their domain. Noah, after all, had mastered the science to build the ark. A vessel, Urquhart pointed out, 450 feet long, 75 broad, and 45 deep. He therefore shared in the knowledge of these men of renown, and navigation must have attained in those antediluvian times to an extraordinary degree of perfection. For the building of the ark, we have only the authority of the Bible. The skeptic, on the other hand, who visits Baalbek, will cease to doubt that the men who could build into its walls stones of the weight of a three-decker with its guns on board could construct a vessel of such immense dimensions. I assume that the antediluvian origin of the one can no more be contested by the critic than that of the other by the believer. Today, and rightly so, skeptics question everything that smacks of credulous superstition and easy belief. The traditions that so excited Urquhart, however, are pervasive. Noah himself is said to be buried in the area, having returned there after the flood, to live out the remainder of his days. And according to Estefan el-Douahi, Maronite patriarch of Lebanon from 1670 to 1704, Baalbek is the most ancient building in the world. It was peopled with giants who were punished for their iniquities by the flood. Other traditions implicate demons in the placing of the megaliths, and an Arabic manuscript echoes the story Urquhart was told about an attempt to rebuild Baalbek after the flood. In this account, it was not Solomon, but Nimrod, the great grandson of Noah, who sent giants to repair the damaged walls. Demons, giants, rollers, capstans, cranes, or aliens? Looking up at the three massive blocks of the trilithon, their base is more than 6 meters, 20 feet above ground level in Baalbek's western wall, I can understand why they were believed to be the work of demons or giants. There is indeed something supernatural, something seemingly impossible about them. Their lengths are respectively 19.60 meters, 64 feet, 3 inches, 19.30 meters, 63 feet, 3 inches, and 19.10 meters, 62 feet, 8 inches. And they're all 4.34 meters, 14 feet, 3 inches high, and 3.65 meters, just a shade under 12 feet wide. They are fitted in place so precisely that it is impossible to insert even the edge of a razor blade into the joints. Go figure is all I can say. But if you want the orthodox take on the subject. Read Jean-Pierre Adam's 1977 paper A propos du trilithon de Baalbek, Le transport et la mise en œuvre des mégalithes. It's still the standard work of reference cited by all skeptics as though it proves their case, and it sets out a proposal deploying rollers of cedar wood on which we are to envisage the blocks being placed. To pull the blocks over the rollers, Adam first considers, then, for logistical reasons, rejects the use of a herd of 800 oxen. Finally, reasoning that weakness of human muscle power can be overcome by technical ingenuity, he settles on multiple arrays of pulleys, rigged up to 6 capstans, each worked by a team of 24 men, making a total of just 144 men to transport the blocks of the trilithon one by one from the quarry half a mile, 800 meters away, to the construction site. At the end of the journey, he calculates that 16 larger capstans, each worked by a team of 32 men, in other words, 512 men in total, would have been required to maneuver the blocks into their final position. The reason for the increased number of capstans and men at the end of the operation is that the wooden rollers would have to be removed, since obviously they could not be left in place in the wall. This would greatly increase the friction between the block and the surface over which it had to be dragged, but the deployment of some kind of lubricant would theoretically reduce the friction enough to avoid any need to lift the blocks. A problem that Adam believes the Romans would have preferred not to confront with blocks of this size. Friedrich Raguet has a slightly different orthodox solution to the challenge of moving and placing the megaliths of the trilithon. In his case, it does involve lifting the blocks at the end of the procedure, which he suggests would have been done using multiple Lewis devices. Metal pieces fitted into specially cut holes in the stones above their center of mass, attached to chains or ropes, and lifted by cranes or winches. The 800-ton block of the trilithon, says Raguet, must have been moved into position by rollers. Then it had to be lifted slightly to allow the removal of the rollers before the tremendous load was lowered inch by inch. If we figure 5 tons lifting capacity per Lewis hole, we would need 160 attachments to the stone. It's not my intention to offer a detailed critique here. I simply note in passing that there are some difficulties with Adam's and Raguet's proposals. Both, for example, rely on wooden rollers, but calculations indicate that the stress of supporting the huge blocks would very quickly have crushed such rollers, even if they were cut from the strongest Lebanon cedar. Likewise, capstans are all very well, and certainly multiply the muscle power that each man is able to exert, but there is a danger, which Adam recognizes, that unless massively anchored to the ground, it would be the capstans rather than the blocks that moved. Finally, every mason understands the principle of Lewis devices and how they work, but there is no sign on the trilithon blocks of even a single Lewis hole, let alone of 160 on each of them. Both Adam and Raguet and others who want to reassure us how unremarkable and unmysterious the whole achievement of the trilithon is, like to preface their accounts with reference to large megaliths that were moved using known technologies in historical times. For example, a 25-meter, 82-feet-tall Egyptian obelisk weighing 320 tons was brought to Rome in the 1st century AD by the Emperor Caligula. Transporting it from Egypt and across the Mediterranean in a specially built ship was itself an incredible feat of engineering, logistics, and heavy lifting. Then, much later, in the 16th century, the same obelisk was moved from where it had stood since Caligula's time and re-erected in St. Peter's Square on the orders of Pope Sixtus V. Likewise in Russia, in the late 18th century, the Thunderstone, a 1,250-ton block of granite, the base for an equestrian statue of Peter the Great that still stands in the city of St. Petersburg, was hauled 7 kilometers overland on a special movable track of bronze spheres. Mind you, it's one thing to drag a supersized megalith in a straight line over bronze ball bearings, or to stand one up in the middle of a huge empty square.